Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's announcement by the Attorney General that 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will be tried by a military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay. International law expert and contributing editor to Harper's, Scott Horton, joins us to discuss this latest example of America shooting itself in the foot in the so-called War on Terror. Then we will turn to the re-emergence of civil war in the Ivory Coast, where the outgoing intransigent loser of the last election is under siege in the capital from forces loyal to the winner of the election, amid reports of massacres of hundreds of civilians attributed to both sides. Nia Kwete, the former executive director of Africa Action and founder of the Democracy and Conflict Center in Accra, Ghana, joins us to sort out what is happening in this latest of Africa's killing fields. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by Deborah Fallows, the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love and Language. She has just returned from China and we'll get an update on the Chinese government's response to the Arab Spring and find out what is happening, what happened to the Jasmine Revolution. Let's now begin with the subject of the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Let's now begin with the announcement by Attorney General Eric Holder today that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called intellectual author of the 9/11 attack, will be tried by a military tribunal at Guantanamo and not in civil court. I'm now joined by Scott Horton, who is a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a wide variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Thank you for joining us here today on Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
To my mind, Scott, the capitulation by the Obama administration, by the Attorney General, in terms of taking a different approach in the so-called War on Terror to their predecessor, George W. Bush, and by trying KSM, as he's called, in civil court, seemed to make sense in the context that from the very beginning after 9/11, we got off on the wrong foot and treated these people, these al-Qaeda people, as the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler, requiring the nation to go to war, as opposed to a band of criminals who should be hunted down and tried as criminals in court. And this final act on Holder's part, to my mind, reinforces that notion that we require an army to arrest a handful of these cave dwellers somewhere on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, that's exactly right. And moreover, it involves a 180-degree turnaround by Eric Holder. A little bit less than 2 years ago, he was making a public statement that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a group of others would be tried in federal court in New York. Right on the heels of this announcement today, we saw the Justice Department even release the indictment. We discovered it in 2009. They had been indicted, and the indictment was sealed in Manhattan. So it seems that everything was set to go. But I think we have this basic problem, and that is the approach that's being taken now, putting them on trial in Guantanamo, appears to be recognizing that they are that they're warriors, and General Joseph Hoar, former CENTCOM commander, late today put out a statement in which he said Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is no warrior; he's a criminal. He should not be treated otherwise. General Hoar and a number of other generals and admirals have come out today with a very strong statement opposing what is being done, and I think the big risk—you put your finger on it—the big risk is one of glorification of their conduct. So I think it's simply inept to be trying them in Guantanamo before a military commission.
And of course, the very word Guantanamo is up there in the lexicon with Abu Ghraib in the minds of Muslims around the world.
Well, that's right. So I think, you know, priority for the United States should have been trying and convicting them as quickly as possible, presenting the world with our evidence that these people are heinous criminals, convincing people of the justice of our system. and trying them. Instead, what happened here, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, remember, was not originally at Guantanamo. He and the worst of the worst were actually held at CIA black sites. It was only in September 2006, in some cases 5 years after these people had been seized, that they were actually turned over to Guantanamo when the black sites were closed. And we now have allowed another 5 years to roll past. They still haven't been tried. So this is a decade later in many cases. It's just an astonishing failure. And I think in this case, we need to keep in mind the incredible political moment. So this decision by Eric Holder is announced at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're told at roughly 10 o'clock in the morning that it's going to be announced. We're told that it's going to be announced at exactly the same time that President Barack Obama announces his reelection campaign is being mounted. And I think you have to see these things in conjunction. It's Barack Obama deciding he doesn't want to make an issue with the Republicans out of what's going to be done with these with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of these other terrorism suspects.
But Scott Horton, if you continue not to make an issue and confront stupidity, then you are there and ignorance and prejudice and wrong-footedness, for the want of a better word, you are in fact adding to America's problems. I mean, it seems like the United States is the gift that keeps on giving as far as bin Laden's concerned. We keep playing out of his playbook. From the very get-go, we described him and his cohorts as jihadis. Jihadi is a noble concept in Islam. That is a person on a spiritual pursuit. Why not from day one call them criminals?
Well, that's right. In fact, I think it gives you a strong sense of what's being done here. So this decision to push forward the way it's being done, the congressional debates, the legislation that was passed in Congress, all of this is aimed to a domestic U.S. audience. It's being done to persuade people, let's say, in the red states of America, across the South and in the Mountain West, that these people are being dealt with aggressively. But in fact, we don't need to persuade the red states of the United States that the U.S. is right and that these people are wrong. That message is for the outside world, especially the Muslim world. And, you know, we need to be dealing with these prisoners in a way that convinces people in the Muslim world that they're criminals, they're thugs. They have committed heinous crimes, and they deserve the sentences that are going to be meted out to them. Calling them jihadis does not do that, exactly as you say. That term is understood across the world with more than 1 billion Muslims as a positive thing. It's describing them as noble. It's complete nonsense.
And, of course, this is all happening at a time when there's this so-called Arab Spring going on, where you have an enormous awakening in the Arab world, a sense that we have always had a kind of quasi-racist prejudice against Arabs with the assumption that they don't somehow want democracy. That myth is being exploded before our eyes. And guess who is the most marginalized by what's going on in the Middle East at the moment? Osama bin Laden. Well, guess what? We brought him back to the headlines.
I think that's all correct. In fact, you know, if you look at the Arab Spring, the word that's been raised most frequently from Morocco to Yemen has been dignity, a cry for dignity. And that, in turn, has been defined in terms of a negative, which is torture and abuse of prisoners. And a lot of the dialogue for dignity was begun throughout this region through criticism of the United States and U.S. policy at Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib and Bagram. Now, many of these countries, that criticism was just a pretext for attacks on their own government, which they knew used exactly these same torture techniques and approaches. But nevertheless, the U.S. has been put on the wrong side of this revolution. It's been lined up with the brutal and authoritarian dictators, the torturers throughout the region. President Obama in his Cairo speech tried to pull back from that image, but I don't think did so very effectively. And I think one of the big problems with this measure, moving these trials back to Guantanamo, is it's going to fall right into that same trap again.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, international expert on international law and contributing editor at Harper's. Of course, the other problem with trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed at Guantanamo before a military tribunal, which was just announced today by the Attorney General, the American public are not going to get the full benefit of what we don't know about the planning behind 9/11 and the execution and all of this, all of the black holes in our knowledge, which have led to a kind of cottage industry of conspiracy about 9/11. So in that broader sense, this is not serving the public interest.
Well, I think there's certainly major issues about process in the commissions, and a lot of that goes to the use of secret evidence, the fact that that some of the hearings themselves can be cut off, that witnesses can testify without being identified, and that really pours gasoline all over these suspicions, all over these conspiracy theories. And I think, frankly, if we get convictions of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his fellow defendants on the basis of secret evidence, that's not going to help us. So, in fact, what we really need, there's really little doubt about the guilt of KSM. He's stated repeatedly that he's prepared to plead guilty. But what we really need to do is put on this probative, convincing evidence that he was behind, he and others were behind 9/11. So secrecy will not help us.
But he was waterboarded over 180 times. So he's already, his credibility is tainted, or at least the credibility of his accusers is tainted, surely.
That's absolutely right. And remember, he's someone whose personality was profoundly impacted by the way he was held. So I think that's going to raise a lot of questions about his evidence. But I think, they need to make their case not on the basis of a confession from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They need to make the case based on what I call probative evidence. That is, independent evidence that links him to the plots, the 9/11 plots. We've been told repeatedly that that evidence exists, but the important thing is that it's presented publicly.
Well, one of the things I find so frustrating, Scott Horton, about these discussions about al-Qaeda and what they've done and how we've been wrong-footed from the beginning, essentially from the, George W. Bush elevating Osama bin Laden to the world stage as an equal player and referring to him as the next Hitler, etc. This has been done nothing but build up their mythology. And, of course, we waged a whole war in Iraq based upon the faulty premise that he had something to do with Iraq, or there's a connection there. But one of the things, apart from the fact that bin Laden could have been, the Saudis actually were trying to make a deal with Mullah Omar to hand him over. There are many incidents where he could have been stopped. But there's also, according to my friend Bob Baer, there's a lot of evidence which he gathered from the so-called Black Prince, a member of the Qatar royal family who went on the lam in Syria and was claiming that the religious minister there, part of the new ruling family that set up the network Al Jazeera, hid KSM from the FBI, who would have arrested him had they not hid him. So, to my mind, there's an awful lot we should learn about, not just what he did, but what happened before he did what he did.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And a public trial would be an excellent vehicle for exposing all of this. The evidence would have to come in, the testimony would come in, the pluses and the minuses. And I think, there's good reason. It's not just conspiracy theorists. It's very, very good reason to think that the U.S. government, U.S. prosecutors have been highly selective in the way they approach these cases, in part because they want to avoid embarrassing facts being introduced. And in fact, the public has a right to know those embarrassing facts, too.
Well, Scott Horton, I guess, we'll sort of watch this one from the sidelines, as bad as it's going to be. And I imagine I'll be talking to you again about this trial, but it just seems to me an exercise in political cowardice on the part of the Obama administration and its attorney general in not educating the American people about who this man is and what he really did and what it really means, as opposed to running scared from stupid right-wing demagoguery.
And if we come back 5 years from now and discover there still hasn't been a trial, count me among the unsurprised.
Again, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine in Legal Affairs and National Security. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what is going on in the Ivory Coast. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Nia Kwete, a policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in the United States public policy. Previously, he served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and he was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana, and the Soros-funded grant-making organization OSIWA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nia Kwete.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, Ian. Thanks for the invitation.
And we last spoke some months back. This has been going on, for 5 months since November, this stalemate where the loser of an election refuses to leave and the winner has been holed up in a hotel. The entire African neighborhood and the United Nations and the world has been urging Gbagbo to leave. It was almost inevitable that it would end up this way because of this man's intransigence, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, it is very hard to figure out what President Gbagbo will do, because all of the principles and all of the guidelines where you think that even, you know, strong-willed leaders, what they might do, I mean, for me, he breaks the mold, because you know that he came to power under dubious circumstances in 2000. At the end of his term in 2005, because of the conflict and the fact that a big chunk of Cote d'Ivoire, the northern part, which is largely Muslim in terms of religion, felt discriminated against a lot. And the symbol of that was Dr. Ouattara, who was prevented over and over from running because his political opponents invented this term of Ivoirite, who is a pure Ivorian, and used that to exclude him. So all of that, these elections, which were supposed to have been held in 2005, let me repeat that, these elections should have been held in 2005. Because of the conflict and the civil war, the UN came in at the invitation of President Gbagbo and the so-called rebels, and they all agreed, and they have lots of different agreements, and they gave a central role to the United Nations to help do the elections. And the UN has done a lot of other things. By my calculation, they spend about $3 billion on Cote d'Ivoire. They've built roads, they've built schools, they've kept the conflict down, they separated the warring parties. But the key task they were giving was to make sure that the elections were clean and fair. And I have to tell you, I mean, I pride myself on being a student of democracy, because I think that's what Africa needs. Now, I'm in a minority of one. Most people, Africans and non-Africans, who look at Africa and how it might make progress, think that you should create a middle class first and democracy will follow. I disagree strongly. I think democracy is the foundation and the means by which you make progress in other areas. So I have studied democracy in Africa very closely. Elections, which are the central portion of democracy, I've looked at those two. My point is that in Cote d'Ivoire, these elections were very meticulous. And as you pointed out, the whole world has come to the conclusion that Alassane Ouattara won, except for President Gbagbo and the people around him. And this has led to this very searing stalemate, which has devastated Cote d'Ivoire and has endangered West Africa, really. Human Rights Watch, for instance, has documented a situation where armed militias and people close to Mr. Gbagbo have been killing West Africans because they say you are not Ivorian, they kill you. So anyway, to cut a long story short, the situation we have in Cote d'Ivoire is very dangerous. It has devastated the country, and it is simply because one person who became president under dubious circumstances, self for 5 years, got an additional 5 years, lost the election, and he does not want to leave.
And the other person who won the election is International Monetary Fund economist Alessandro Ouattara. And the person who lost the elections, who won't leave office and who is in fact forcing a battle in the very capital. And now, just as before we went to air, the French UN forces have used helicopter gunships on his weapons depots because on orders from the UN Secretary General, because Gbagbo was targeting the UN headquarters as well as the main hotel where the press are. But what's extraordinary, just to give you an idea of how intransigent Gbagbo is, he's a 65-year-old former history professor, and among the offers he turned down was one from Barack Obama, proposing that this offering up a history professorship at a Boston university in return for Gbagbo stepping down peacefully. So there you have some of the history. But at the moment, apparently he's going to he's holed up within the palace and in the main area in the middle of the town there of the city, and he's basically keeping everybody indoors and forcing the other side to fight block by block, which will result in huge civilian casualties. So this is and of course prior to this there have been reports of both sides committing massacres of civilian populations. So start with the massacres on both sides.
That is true. You know, there have been allegations. I mean, until a week ago, last Monday, the 28th of March, was when the forces that used to be called Force Nouvelle, the rebels, they are now called the Republican Forces of Cote d'Ivoire, and they swear allegiance to the man who won the elections, Dr. Ouattara. They began moving because they lost patience because they saw that Mr. Gbagbo was playing games, and they made very fast advances. So a week ago today, they took the big important town in western Cote d'Ivoire, southwestern Cote d'Ivoire, called Douekoué. Now, initially, it looked like there was no fighting, but this weekend, when observers went in, Caritas, the Red Cross, and the UN itself, they found a lot of dead bodies. We've seen some of them on the international media TV programs. Now, there is a big dispute about the numbers. The UN has come out and said that they are as low as 200. Caritas, at the other end, has said that there are 1,000 people, and so far, the forensics say that these people were killed after the Republican forces took over. So people are saying that it must have been those responsible, those swearing allegiance to Dr. Ouattara. But they've pointed out that they've called for an international investigation. A high-level UN Assistant Secretary General flew in on Sunday to supervise. So that was occurred less than a week ago. But in the 4 or 5 months since the election stalemate, there have been about 500 people killed in Abidjan, mostly, and most of them were killed by Mr. Gbagbo's soldiers. They fired into markets where women were selling vegetables. Then there were women before that, like a week before that, there were an instance where women were marching peacefully, and it's been captured on tape. I mean, CNN has got one of the tapes where you can see the women marching with nothing but branches and leaves. They were machine gunned, and seven of them were killed. There have been reports of abductions and things. So when we find out what happened in Duweku in Southwest, it may well be that FORCE is loyal to Dr. Ouattara, has committed some atrocities, and he has said that whoever did it must be punished and it's being investigated. But what we do know for sure is that Mr. Egwuregwu had used intimidation and xenophobia and in intimidating all the followers, a lot of people, the 500 who had been killed so far before the Duweku reports were mostly Ouattara supporters.
So, apparently the Ouattara's forces have a group in them, a group of hunters called Dozos, is that right?
That is true. In fact, you know, that is very much a West African tradition. You have them in Liberia, you have them in Sierra Leone, you have them in Cote d'Ivoire, you know, because this is heavily rainforest, and hunting is a thousands-old tradition. And because they are good at shooting bows and arrows and guns and hunting, they become local self-defense militias. And usually they can get into fights with other groups. Now, according to the Ouattara people, they have said that, look, they think the killings were mostly between different militias, because one of the things that Gbagbo had done was had recruited mercenaries from across the border, his western border, from Liberia. And so there are different militia groups, and that's the claim. But yes, the Dozos are traditional hunters who can switch from hunting game to be armed militia and fighting. Now, the Ouattara government claims that no, their forces have not made an alliance with the Dozos. So the case is still being investigated.
Again,
what we do know for sure, because we've seen, is that at the very least, hundreds of people were killed in Duweku, which is shocking, within less than a week. Because for the last five months since the elections, you've had about 500 people killed in Abidjan, and that was shocking. And the number of people that have just been massacred in Duweku is just absolutely shocking. One more thing, Ian. For me, what is interesting is if you look at the geography, Duweku is just about the biggest town in interior to the Ivory Coast that's closest to Liberia. There have been 1 million people displaced. In fact, more than 1 million. 1 million displaced from Abidjan alone. Most of them are internally displaced. But of those who have gone outside Liberia, outside Cote d'Ivoire, you have about 120,000. 90% of those are in just Liberia alone. And that tells you that the area close to Liberia has been full of tension and fighting and war, and therefore innocent civilians leave their homes and cross over into Liberia. My point is that it points to the fact that even before the Ouattara forces arrived in Duweku, there were tensions and fighting before they got there.
Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross say there were 800 people killed, and clearly, yeah, though, at this point, even as bad as both of these people may be, Gbagbo is playing the ugly colonialist card on state media. This has terrified the 12,000 French nationals. But prior to that, you mentioned earlier his Ivorité program, which basically divided the southern Christian region from and made them the true Ivorians and pitted that against the north, mostly Muslim. So that seems to have been his MO. He's been isolated. Now the UN is going after him and his money's been cut off. He's also suffered a tremendous amount of defections within his military. So do you think that his whole thing's going to fall apart before all these civilians trapped inside the capital get massacred?
I certainly hope so. That's my, that's my expectation as well. Because, you know, as you mentioned, just today, because he's been, for months, he's been harassing the UN forces, not just verbally, but actually burning UN vehicles, even shooting at UN peacekeepers. They felt they had enough, and they used air power Just before we came on the air, some of the reports I'm getting, the UN troops, some of their spokesmen in Abidjan claim that now Gbagbo is just holed up, his forces are holed up in two or three isolated areas in Abidjan. I certainly hope that is true, and therefore my hope is that this should be over within a week. But I'm no military expert, and I am talking from Washington. I'm just going by the news I get. So it may well be that my prediction will not come true, but I will be very surprised if it lasts longer than a week, because he's not even in control of all of Abidjan. The airport is in the hands of the first the UN and then the French. The Abidjan is a sprawling oceanside city with a lagoon meandering. So there are three key bridges. The bridges are now all out of the hands of Mr. Gbagbo. So he's been confined to pockets. And given that the UN and the French now are using their air power, I hope and expect that within a week, this fighting should come to an end. Now, one other interesting thing that happened over the weekend is that Philip Mangu, who is the chief of Gbagbo's army, we have heard stories that there was mistrust between him and the president. Then we heard that he had defected with his family and gone to the South African embassy. Now, the interesting and intriguing thing is that now we hear he's gone back to President Gbagbo, and so we are speculating. If he was running away, why did he go back? Some of my friends think that maybe he was sent to talk to the South African embassy. Now, if that's true, what were they talking about? One possibility, we hope.
Well, the South Africans have basically had tacit support for Gbagbo, but I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Niakwete. Let's stay in touch, and hopefully your prediction is right that this will all be over soon.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Niakwete, policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously, he served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and he was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana, and the Soros-funded grant-making foundation, OSIWA. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Deborah Fellows, who's just back from China. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Deborah Fellows, the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Languages. She holds a doctorate in linguistics, speaks six languages, and has lived in Shanghai and Beijing and traveled throughout China for several years with her husband, writer James Fellows. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Fellows.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be here.
The Arab Spring is not welcome in Beijing, I understand. And it's creating a kind of an interesting backlash. Both the Chinese government are appalled by what's happening, and obviously they don't want that to spread to China. But I read some recent reports where Chinese, middle-class Chinese, were also saying, well, see, this proves it. When you have democracy and revolution, things fall apart, and we don't want that kind of instability here. So given your long experience there in China, do you think that the Tiananmen memories are entirely erased?
Well, Ian, we've just come back from 2 months in China on this recent trip, and so we were there for all of these upheavals that have been going on in the Arab world lately, and so kind of trying to get an idea of what's going on in China. And it's been a really interesting reaction, because you're right. On the one hand, the government is pretty simply saying, we don't approve of what's going on. Of course, they didn't go take the final step of vetoing this at the UN. But every time you see it on TV or hear it in the headlines, it's we don't like this military force in Libya or other places, period. That's kind of simply it. On the other hand, you do definitely there's a feeling of anxiety and tension within China for kind of potential for copycat uprisings and copycat upheaval, not necessarily about Arab issues, but just that this is on people's minds and it's an opportunity. I mean, kind of China kind of always reacts to an occasion to clamp down and tighten up and oversee and watch the public. There are lots of occasions, the Olympic state visits. This time it's, you know, Libya or Egypt or pick a country. And it's hard to get a real sense of what the Lao Baixing, the regular people, the ordinary people, the masses of people, how they're reacting to this. You kind of get a peripheral sense. There's a lot of buzz on the internet, and there were these the so-called Jasmine Revolution potential for gatherings and protests and some kind of uprisings throughout the country. And things went on, but the reaction from the government is so immediate, so heavy-handed, and so kind of out of proportion to what you felt was the sentiment coming from the public for any kind of protest that it like was stopped before it started. There were little buzzes on the internet. Meet on Tuesday or meet on Sunday at 2 o'clock at Wang Fujing, which is kind of Wilshire Boulevard or something, and to gather to protest. So if you went down to Wang Fujing at 2 o'clock on Sunday, you'd see all kinds of police presence, all kinds of plainclothes presence, a few befuddled tourists, and a few other people just kind of wandering around, and that's it. So any kind of sense that there could be a gathering was on the one hand real, on the other hand, it just didn't, it barely materialized into anything. The Tiananmen is, it's a bigger deal for us to think about and remember than it is for the Chinese. A lot of them, especially the young people, don't even honestly know about it, haven't even heard about it. It's not in their school books. It's not in their history books. But that is among the savvy ones and among those who would be so inclined to go down to Wang Fujing and protest. It is in the recent memory.
Well, again, Deborah Feller is author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. And as Deborah Feller has just said, she's just returned from China with her husband, James Feller. Obviously, your language lessons and the subsequent cultural lessons that you picked up as well informs, I guess, what we're talking about here in the sense that we in the West have very preconceived ideas about China, and particularly in terms of them being kind of monolithic and having a herd mentality, and maybe because the language itself requires you to learn by rote so many characters before you can even become literate and read a newspaper. That's one of the explanations I've heard. So give us a sense of, because you hear so many stories about these very brave and individualistic Chinese on the one hand bucking this authoritarian system. But on the other hand, you're given this impression that they all just want to make money and they don't give a damn about human rights and democracy.
Yeah. It's interesting, first, that you talk about China as the monolith, because that was certainly our impression before we went to China for this long stay starting in 2006. And I think the first takeaway lesson we had from being there is that China is anything but a monolith. You can start with the language. While everybody can read the same characters, that the spoken language now is officially Mandarin, but really what's going on in China are, 50 different dialects, countless different accents, 6 or 7 different major language families, and an overlay of Mandarin finally starting about 50 years ago as the lingua franca of the country. Everybody can read the same characters, but what you're reading from the Shanghai dialect to the Hunan dialect to the northern China dialect sounds very different. So you see the same thing, but it sounds extremely different. That kind of extends into the life and lifestyle and culture and everydayness of China as being no way to describe it a monolith. There, I think if anything, you absolutely get the sense that these 1.3 billion people are 1.3 billion individuals. And again, you're right, as while what we hear about are the human rights violations, which are true and which are horrific, especially recently, again. But also equally true is this sense that these 1.3 billion people are out there to improve their standard of living and their lifestyle. I'd say one of the biggest changes that we noticed. So we went to China from 2006 to 2009. So we've been back in the U.S. for about a year and a half. However, we were just back in China for 2 months. So in that interim period of about a year plus, we saw tremendous changes in the lifestyle. It was almost as though, okay, our preoccupation with the Olympics is over. We did it. We did a great job. We presented ourselves to the world. And now it's kind of shifting back towards business as usual or life as usual in China. And it's all about improving the lot of individuals from me and my neighbor to the 700 million peasant class population that are out in the countryside. So it's mass movements and individual movements for improving lifestyle. And Beijing looks a whole lot better than it did a year ago. It's just kind of spit and polish. Well, that's probably an exaggeration, but the sidewalks aren't so beat up.
A lot of spit and a lot of polish.
A lot of spit. Actually, a lot less spit. That's what.
Because you mentioned that going to the sea of people going into the subway, and amidst that sea, there's people spitting all over the place.
Spitting all over the place. But there is there's been this, quote, movement to civilize life around China, especially in the major cities. So there's less spitting going on. There's a lot of shoving and kind of trying to get one step ahead of you no matter where you are on the sidewalk. But the sidewalks are less rough and shoddy. You know, they're smoothed out now. You don't kind of go tripping over rubbles of pavement like you did before. In the subways, there are, very curiously, you've got in the old number one and number two line where they've been around for a long time, and they're the kind of intersection for the railroad stations and the long-distance bus line. You've got all kinds of shoving and pushing. You can barely make your way. In the new subway lines, number 10, which is going around the city to the university, it's very handsome and very sleek, and people line up and don't push and shove onto those subways the way they do on the number 1 and 2 line. So you've got new, organized, somewhat rule-behaving, cleaned-up, fancy, westernized Beijing meeting old Beijing at the same time. I think it'll never change. You know, you don't have to rush there tomorrow because it still will be old China meeting new China. But it's definitely getting the feel of becoming more fashionable, more fancy places. You see people not necessarily dressing in Western fashion more, but a sense that they're paying attention more to fashion. They're interested in Western, in modern restaurants as well as old restaurants. Here's one really surprising thing to me I heard when we first went back to China. When you see your old friends after not having seen them for a while, you say the equivalent of long time no see, which is hao jiao bu jian, literally long time no see. That's the very common kind of introduction. This time when we went back to China, the first thing that three of my women friends said to me was not long time no see, but wo bian pang le, which means I've gotten fat. And this word pang, which means fat, used to be a really neutral word in Chinese. Like,
isn't that mahjong? No, pang, is that?
Pang could mean a lot of other things, yeah. Like pong or put it or something, yeah. But this particular pong is fat. Right. But it's not fat in a negative sense. Like if I said to you, hey, you're looking a little fat today, if you said that in Chinese, in Mandarin to someone, it would be the same as though you're saying, oh, you got a haircut, or I see your new shoes. Completely neutral statement. With this kind of wo bian pang le, I felt, and you could hear, that this attention to, uh-oh, we're a nation that's getting fat and I'm one of them, was part of the new mentality. And this, even this word pang was suddenly taking on a kind of negative connotation like it has taken on in all of the Western places. And in fact, I would say I certainly noticed that in Beijing, we saw a lot more chubby, chubby going to fat people, and you know, the statistics bear that up. Now, quote, 10% of Chinese are obese, and diabetes is on the increase, and so forth. So along with all this, you know, modernization and westernization, you get chubby.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. And Coca-Cola everywhere.
Kentucky yeah. Fried.
And new billboards for the presentation of Fat Burger, which I've never been to a Fat Burger. I guess it's like In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah, but it's one down the road. Yeah.
Okay, Fat Burger chain is coming to China, and everybody seems very interested in it. So we'll see what happens to that word fat. It's kind of a metaphor for changing China, I think.
Wow. Again, I'm speaking with Deborah Fallows, the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin, Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. And as you mentioned earlier, that China did not veto the... They abstained from the resolution vis-a-vis Libya, but there was discussions there at the time that one of the reasons why, of course, nobody likes to sit by passively and watch civilians getting slaughtered by a modern military, as in the case of Gaddafi killing his own people. But the theory was that the Chinese and the Russians would veto it because they've done the same thing in Chechnya and in Tibet. And there's this general sense that what motivates the Chinese more than anything is this kind of idea of the Han families being the dominant part of China and that the peripheries are somehow the lesser people. So give us a sense of that notion that we have of kind of Han Chinese prejudice against the outside world.
I think what you feel in China is the tensions within China of the various strong tribal groups. I mean, I think the Chinese are really paying more attention to what's going, the Chinese people paying more attention to what's going on within China domestically than to the outside world. So it was kind of there wasn't that much national interest that you felt in about Libya.
Or Egypt or the
Egypt.
Arab Spring.
It was there, but there was a statement, and everybody was kind of okay with that, and then it went on. But this tribal tension, I wouldn't really say tension, but cohesion, in effect. In effect, they're more Han than anything else, and they are kind of generally in power. But I think, in a way, the more interesting story is the reaction to Japan and the earthquake than the reaction to Libya. Because China has had long tensions with Japan, and you hear people popping out with phrases like, I hate the Japanese. I heard this even from one of my tutors, whom I connected with again, young 30-year-old woman. Just we were talking about the earthquake, and I said, you know, what's the sentiment here? What's going on in China with response to this earthquake and the tsunami? And the first reaction is, we hate the Japanese. In fact, you saw a couple different things going on in the national reaction. One is that the Chinese were officially very happy to help out with earthquake recovery efforts, and there was a lot of footage on TV of sending their experienced people after Sichuan to go help out in China. And donating money. There were the kind of officially sanctioned lines of people putting red envelopes into boxes for the Japanese. On the other hand, there was a slight undercurrent, especially in the kind of far-out internet world, of saying, and this is a little bit horrible, but actually saying, okay, the Japanese deserved this. First they came to Nanking, and you had the rape of Nanking. And now they're sending us their radioactive
clouds, right?
Which is, of course, preposterous, but it is in the mentality so strong, and the propaganda in the schooling, in the education, and in the school books that the kids read so strong that it's hard for the masses of Chinese to get over this feeling that we don't like the Japanese and a little bit of peripheral in some way, maybe they deserved this. Mm. And yet, you know, it is kind of, once again, I hate to keep using the word metaphor, but metaphor for all things are true in China at once. On the one hand, we hate the Japanese. On the other hand, we'll help the Japanese, and we're sorry about this, and we'll send our people there to help them.
Well, just in closing, Deborah Fallows, you mentioned how Mandarin has become the official language, even though the dialects are all so different. And I'm wondering whether this has had a kind of homogenizing effect on China itself, because one of the extraordinary things about China, you talked about tribalism in the Chinese context, is how many little nooks and crannies of China have ancient traditions that are so different. There's one group of women in some lake district in the middle of nowhere that runs a matriarchy. And I'm just wondering whether all of that diversity in China is going to be lost as China becomes the world's dominant superpower.
Well, we'll see first if they become the world's dominant superpower. Certainly well, they're going to be a player.
Yeah, they've already passed Japan as number two.
That's true. But I think rather than saying it that the Mandarin language will have a homogenizing effect, that it's probably more accurate to say that it will have the effect of making this country work more efficiently and more kind of normally and reasonably together as a coherent unit. It is such a vast country. There are so many different ethnic groups. They're so far away and still remote from each other and even isolated and insulated that and proud of their heritages, which are tolerated and even kind of encouraged to a point by the government, that I think there's no risk of those disappearing, but rather that the language you can see as actually a really good thing for getting all of those remote areas an avenue to become part of the conversation, engaged, an idea of what's going on in Beijing or in other cities. It's remarkable that this is a single country, period, and operating as such. It's a wonderful thing that the language is, as a lingua franca, can give all of the people who are outside the mainstream in East Coast cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, etc., a way to connect and be part of the conversation and the literature and the voice to the extent that that exists in China at all. I see it as a move all for good and efficiency rather than a threat to making it into the monolith that is our impression that China is, which is wrong.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Deborah Fallows. I've been speaking with Deborah Fallows, the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. She holds a doctorate in linguistics, speaks six languages, and has lived in Shanghai and Beijing and traveled throughout China for several years with her husband, James Fallows, and was just there recently. Thank you again, Deborah.
Thank you, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you've heard something you like, something that you don't like, any suggestions or tips, let me know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog at ianmasters.com. Just click on blog. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.